Grace and peace, everybody. It's good to be here with all of you. We certainly live in very interesting times, times that can be unsettling. I actually think that what we've been looking at as we've been going through the book of Matthew, particularly what Jesus says about parables and his use of parables, is very relevant for the age that we live in today. I thought for my sermon today that I would share some thoughts on how Jesus as communicator compares and contrasts with how our culture is communicating. Somebody recently asked me about a style of communicating where you set up a microphone on a college campus and you basically have live debates with people, and then you take some clips that are particularly juicy and you put those on YouTube and you see how many views you can get. And you try to get like a really good soundbite where you come up with something clever in the moment to kind of show the person how wrong they are. And I have questioned that approach. I'm not at all convinced that that is the way that we should be operating. And the reason for that is that it just seems very un-Jesus-like. It seems like when Jesus was communicating, he didn't want to give his teaching to hostile environments. That he, with particularly with his parables, what he would do is he would withdraw and he would wait to have people come to him in these more private atmospheres and then give the truth to those who are searching. And there was something about that style that fits with what we saw earlier in the book of Matthew, where Jesus says to not give your pearls before swine. In other words, like you're not supposed to take these very valuable truths and just indiscriminately give them to people. And it's very interesting when you read the whole section there of what he speaks about, which is in the Sermon on the Mount. He says, "Do not give dogs what is holy, and do not throw your pearls before pigs, lest they trample them underfoot and turn to attack you." So that's very interesting that he says that if you engage in that kind of communication, you're inviting attacks on yourself. So, generally speaking, that style of communication, which is so popular, and there's so much of it on YouTube, and I have to admit, my style is to want to engage in debates, and I like, oh yeah, what did he say? And you see how many millions of views there are, and you want to click on that, and it's I'm probably who those algorithms are targeting. There's an important framework that a woman who's a professor of linguistics at Georgetown has proposed. Her name is Deborah Tannen. And she wrote a book in 1998 that I think was just a very prescient book that really made some insightful statements about where America was and where it was going. And the title of her book, 1998, is called The Argument Culture. The Argument Culture. And in this book, what she does is she says that America is now and is heading towards a culture that has the following properties. It believes that considering someone else's ideas equals condoning those ideas. It means that you don't just disagree with people, you demonize them, and that in general, people have forgotten the power of words. Biblically, we would say the power of the tongue. And there's generally a de-emphasis, according to Tannen's book, generally a de-emphasis on truly listening and understanding, and more on talking over people and trying to get in the last word. I'll read you just from the book jacket here, because I think it's pretty amazing what she came up with back in 1998. She says, it's a secular book, but nonetheless very insightful. The argument culture is about a pervasive, warlike atmosphere that makes us approach anything we need to accomplish as a fight between two opposing sides. The argument culture urges us to regard the world and the people in it in an adversarial frame of mind. It rests on the assumption that opposition is the best way to get anything done. The best way to explore an idea is to set up a debate. The best way to cover the news is to find spokespeople who express the most extreme, polarized views and present them as both sides. The best way to settle disputes is litigation that pits one party against the other. The best way to begin an essay is to oppose someone. And the best way to show you're really thinking is to criticize and attack. The war on drugs, the war on cancer, the battle of the sexes, politicians' turf battles. In the argument culture, war metaphors pervade our talk and shape our thinking. Tannen shows how deeply entrenched this cultural tendency is, the forms it takes and how it affects us every day, sometimes in useful ways, but often causing rather than avoiding damage. And this last line is, I think, particularly predictive. In the argument culture, the quality of information we receive is compromised, and our spirits are corroded by living in an atmosphere of unrelenting contention. So, again, she writes this in 1998, and here we are today, October 5th, in the middle of a government shutdown with no clear end in sight, as the parties can't agree, and many people are not receiving their paychecks as a result. I think she nailed it. She absolutely described where America was and where it was going. And you can see this in many different ways. I was looking earlier today at a previous slide set that I had prepared for a different group, and I had shown the cover of a book by Ann Coulter. And the title of the book is Demonic, subtitle, How the Liberal Mob is Endangering America. That's the name of her book, Demonic. And it's written in red with this really dark background. It's kind of like, even the book cover is sort of scary. And it's literally demonizing opponents. So here we are again, as I mentioned, in the middle of a shutdown. This was a piece that was written in the last shutdown that we were in, so I thought it would be fitting to read this to illustrate this kind of argument culture. It's written by Judge Jeanine Pirro, and the title is Nancy Pelosi, You're a Shutdown Hypocrite. Stop playing games and negotiate. The article goes on to say, you vacation in Hawaii, your buddies vacation with lobbyists in Puerto Rico during the shutdown, and you plan a jaunt to Europe while federal employees are trying to save every dollar to buy groceries. Admit it, you don't give a blank expletive there. Nancy, you're a hypocrite, a political operative. Your mantra, destroy the president of the United States. To hell with the tax-paying, hardworking Americans. Let them eat cake. I've got a junket to go on, an ego to assuage, and an electorate to ignore. And Nancy, if you're too afraid to take a commercial flight, there are alternate ways to fly. Check this one out. It's a broomstick, and it's tailor-made for you. So that is an article that was published in one of the leading websites out there. And interestingly, these individuals, both of the ones that I just cited with the book Demonic and the article here, they wear big crosses when they do these interviews. They'll be gold or silver. Sometimes they'll have diamonds in them. And they're very ostensibly outspoken with their Christian beliefs. So the world obviously sees this, the world sees these books and this kind of rhetoric. I think it's safe to say that we have a major, major problem on our hands right now. And this argument culture is one that Christianity has been swept into because a lot of people who are professing Christians have embraced this argument culture, even very recently. So I want to talk this evening about this problem, a little bit about how we got here, and some proposals on how to fix it. Just to talk about some more of the why, this is another article here that, I think this is my last quote from an article, but from 2022, from a writer named Tim Alberta. He was writing for The Atlantic, And this article, it's a great article. I'd recommend it. It's called How Politics Poisoned the Evangelical Church. And I'll read to you what the article says. Christianity has traditionally been seen as a stabilizing, even moderating influence on American life. In 1975, more than two-thirds of Americans expressed a great deal or quite a lot of confidence in the church, according to Gallup. Okay, so two-thirds in 1975. And as of 1985, organized religion was the most revered institution in American life. That was a quote. Today, Gallup reports, just 37% of Americans have confidence in the church. This downward spiral owes principally to two phenomena: the constant stench of scandal, with megachurches and prominent leaders imploding on what seems like a weekly basis, and the growing perception that Christians are embracing extremist views. One rarely needs to read to the bottom of a poll to learn that the religious group most opposed to vaccines, most convinced that the 2020 presidential election was stolen, most inclined to subscribe to QAnon conspiracy theories, is white evangelicals. So this article goes through and it talks about how there's been this nexus of politics and religion that has been very corrosive towards trust. And I've shown this before in other settings. Some of you might have seen it. But if you look at just the percentage of people who call themselves Christian in the U.S. and in Europe, it's pretty much a steady line downward over the last 25 years. It's quite depressing. In addition to those issues, there's still this general feeling that the church is irrelevant for the major problems of the world. Right now, there's so much, as there should be, talk about Gaza and Ukraine, but people don't think even remotely begin to think, oh, the answer for those problems is contained inside of the church. In general, people still puzzle at the church. There's a big, beautiful church building right across the way here, made of stone. And I think a lot of people walk by and think, what good is it? What do people do in there? How in the world does that help the world? It's a place where people think is quaint, where people sing some songs, they have cookies, they drink their lemonade. At worst, it's where there are people who are cheating people out of their money and advancing their own political agenda. The church is simply not seen as the place of hope or the place of answers to the problems of the world. So this is a big problem. We have the problem of irrelevance. We have the problem of scandals. There was another one just over the last week. There is the problem of these extreme views. And then there's the problem of political associations. These are not good times. These are not happy times for the brand name, so to speak, of the church. So what are we supposed to do with this? I'm gonna make some points here. I'm gonna make 5 points on how I think we can get out of this hole and even reclaim ground that has been lost. So the first point I'd like to make is that we should vigorously reject today's argument culture. Vigorously reject today's argument culture. I'll read first a verse from Philippians chapter 2 that says this: do everything without grumbling or arguing, so that you may become blameless and pure, children of God without fault in a warped and crooked generation. Then you will shine among them like stars in the sky as you firmly hold to the word of life. Okay, so he says, here Paul's writing, he says, do everything without grumbling or arguing. That's an amazing line, isn't it? Do everything without arguing. And I think that alone is a strong rebuke to a lot of the modes of communication that really center on arguing, or at least contain arguing as prominent components. In Paul's mind, this is essential to be blameless and pure. And I think the reason for this is that when we enter into that arguing mindset, you begin alienating people and putting stumbling blocks in front of people, and it is unnecessary. There's another very famous passage on this topic that you've heard before, but I want you to listen to it with fresh ears in the light of this argument culture that we live in now. 1 Peter 3:15-16 says, "In your hearts honor Christ the Lord as holy, always being prepared to make a defense to anyone who asks you for a reason for the hope that is in you, yet do it with gentleness and respect, having a good conscience, so that when you are slandered, those who revile your good behavior in Christ may be put to shame." So he says here that we, when we have these discussions, we're to have the overriding attributes of gentleness and respect. And I can tell you right now, you can watch these videos, that is not what people would walk away with when they watch these videos, especially the ones that get a lot of hits. They don't say like, "Oh, wow, there was such gentleness. There was such respect." It's the exact opposite. This is, I think, a great indictment of the strategy that the church has adopted, which, again, it scores a lot of points. You can get a lot of hits on YouTube, but it, in the end, is something that will cause us to be warped and crooked. I'll read you a quote here from two authors. Their names are Langer and Muehlhoff, that say this. Peter, talking about this passage, Peter exhorts us to give a defense and to do it with gentleness and respect. In other words, we are to declare the truth, be prophetic, and we are to show gentleness and respect, be civil. Prophetic civility. I find this compelling because I frequently see Christians being so prophetic that they are uncivil, or so civil that they are unprophetic. If prophetic civility sounds oxymoronic, consider the life of Jesus. He was a friend of sinners, a moniker his enemies gave him because it was descriptively accurate. He actually was a friend of sinners, and though he befriended tax collectors and prostitutes, he never denied their sins. Indeed, in his presence, the tax collectors and prostitutes often called themselves sinners. That's a great insight. Here's my argument. Jesus modeled prophetic civility. Peter commands it, so we should practice it. I think that's a powerful insight there. So I think right off the bat, we just have to say no to this. And it is very, very tempting to want to enter into this fray. It is very tempting to want to be the next video that is on Instagram or YouTube. My second point is that we should vigorously embrace an action-oriented culture of good works and love. We should vigorously embrace an action-oriented culture of good works and love. Matthew 5, Sermon on the Mount, is a great place for us to go back to and remember what Jesus said in verses 13-16, where he says, "You are the salt of the earth, but if the salt loses its flavor, how shall it be seasoned? It is then good for nothing but to be thrown out and trampled underfoot by men. You are the light of the world. A city that is set on a hill cannot be hidden. Nor do they light a lamp and put it under a basket, but on a lampstand, and it gives light to all who are in the house. Let your light so shine before men that they may see your good works and glorify your Father in heaven." The consensus understanding, which I think is correct from this passage, is that salt here is being used in the sense that most people would have wanted salt in the ancient times, which was as a preservative. So you can take, for example, a piece of meat. You can heavily salt that piece of meat, and it will dry and preserve meat. Obviously, this is long before they had refrigerators, and so you would need to do that if you were going to survive even. In many cases, you would need an adequate supply of salt. This metaphor implies that the world is rotting, that it is in this state where it is decaying. And so if you picture this slab of meat that is stinking, it is decaying, the salt will prevent that from happening. what's the conclusion from this? Is that the downward movement that we see in the world today, the confusion on gender, the confusion on sexuality, the violence, the greed, all these things, all of these are evidences of the failure of the church. This is a very important point, that Jesus is saying that the church is supposed to have this preservative or salt-like function. And so when we're not doing our job, guess what happens? The world will decay and rot. If the church were actually being salt, it would halt the rotting. However, what do we see more often than not, and this is related to this argument culture, is that when people are bothered, their tendency is to blame the world and to say, what's wrong with those dirty people? But instead, the real question that we should be asking is, how have we failed? How have we failed to be the salt and light that Jesus calls us to be? I find it fascinating that Jesus didn't say, you are the sugar of the world. He could have said that. Or, you are the honey of the world. He could have said either of those. The problem is that many churches have become either places of sugary sap, where there's not salt. Salt has that bite, right? When you eat salt, it has that little bit of sting, a little bit of tang to it. Or simply churches have become part of the meat. They've become corroding. They're corroding alongside of the meat. In addition, what we know about salt is, in order to work, it has to spread out. It has to be distributed across the surface of whatever it is it's trying to preserve. You don't just put it in one clump on one part of the meat. It has to be distributed and spread out. These are both areas in which I think the church has done poorly. One of the things that Jesus says in the conclusion of this in verse 16 is, he says, let your light so shine before men that they may see your good works and glorify your Father in heaven. And notice that. See your good works. It's not hear your nice songs or hear the words that you're saying. It's see, visually see your good works. There's a great line in English that you all know, which says that actions speak louder than words. It's very true. Our actions speak much, much louder than our words. What is it, and I would love maybe afterwards to have a conversation about this, what are the specific works that the world is supposed to observe? Because guess what Jesus says here? He says that they may see your good works and glorify your Father in heaven, that seeing of the good works leads to a praising of God. That's a powerful idea. So Jesus here uses the word good works. He says that good works are going to be the mechanism, this winsome way, this way that people are drawn into praising God, not by arguing, but by seeing good works. John 13 has a related idea, somewhat similar, where he says, a new commandment I give you, that you love one another as I have loved you, that you also love one another. By this, all will know that you are my disciples, if you have love for one another. So a lot of people wonder, like, wait, why is Jesus even calling this a new commandment? Loving our neighbor was commanded even in the Old Testament. It's in Leviticus 19, love your neighbor as yourself. That was there. The reason that it's new here is that it is Jesus speaking in the context of this foot washing. So this is right at the end of this foot washing event that happens. And Jesus here is saying that he is demonstrating that despite being their Lord and their teacher, that he is setting for them an example that they should follow. It even says just a few verses earlier, in the same chapter, now that I, your Lord and teacher, have washed your feet, you also should wash one another's feet. I have set you as an example that you should do as I have done for you. Very truly I tell you, no servant is greater than his master, nor is a messenger greater than the one who sent him. Now that you know these things, you will be blessed if you do them. So it's new because the standard is Jesus. It is a much higher standard than we have in the Old Testament. So that is something that should raise the bar, just like he raises the bar in the Sermon on the Mount. He basically says here that the badge, if you will, of being a Jesus follower, is this love for one another. There are many reasons why we should not wear crosses. I won't get into that for this sermon here. One of the reasons why we should not wear crosses is that we have another badge that we're supposed to wear instead, which is this badge here, which is loving one another. This is the badge that we, if we're authentic, this is what we should be displaying. The other way we can see this culture of good works and love being the alternative is what Jesus says in John 17, 20 to 21, where he says, "I do not pray for these alone, but also for those who will believe in me through their word, that all may be one, that they all may be one, as you, Father, are in me and I in you, that they also may be one in us, that the world may believe that you sent me." It is supposed to be the case that there should be a radical contrast between the division and partisan politics of the world compared to the unity of the church. And again, right now is a great time where we can see partisan politics on display. And I think a lot of people are just very tired of seeing all of the fighting and all of the name-calling and all of the just childishness that we see almost daily. And what Jesus is saying here is, here's a way that the world may believe that you, Father, have sent me, Jesus. And he's saying it's going to be in this unity that the church models here. So this is why we have spent a lot of time as a church studying conflict resolution and made this really a major theme over the last 2 years of our teachings and our practices. So instead of this argument culture that Deborah Tannen talks about, we're supposed to have this culture of action-oriented, visual, things that you can see, good works. Our badge is supposed to be love for one another, and unity is supposed to be the great contrast between us and the divisions of this world. Be thinking about the good works, though, because I do want to try to unpack this more. Number three, recognize the true sources of the body's discipleship. Recognize the true sources of the body's discipleship. In that article that I had mentioned before from The Atlantic, this one of the pastors who's interviewed in this article, he comes to this realization that it's a very powerful insight. He says, okay, I'm giving these 45-minute sermons once a week. People are hearing that on Sunday. But then he says this, quote, "Rush Limbaugh had them for 3 hours a day, 5 days a week, and Fox News had them every single night." And he realizes that his 45 minutes once a week was overshadowed by all this Rush Limbaugh and all this Fox News that they were getting. 45 minutes a week is not enough to tip the scales when someone is being so discipled and so influenced by pick the favorite person that someone might follow here. Discipleship is not merely what happens on Sunday. It's who you listen to, who you talk to, who you hang out with, and in particular, the things that you put into your mind and in your heart. This is easily one of the great problems of the modern church, which is this failure to recognize that discipleship comes in ways that we don't realize. And so we can have someone who's a nominal Christian, they're going to church, they're sitting there, but in fact they're being discipled by somebody else through the media. What does it look like? And I want each of us to think about this. What does it look like to set our minds on things above, not on things below? The world wants so badly for you to click on that video or that website or that ad. There are literally billions and billions of dollars that are being spent in order to draw you to think about the things below. The incentives are powerful. There's very skilled scientists and behavioral researchers who are doing their very, very best in order to get your mind not on the things above, but to bring them down below. And I think this is something that, like I said, we, even in the best of churches, people can get more discipleship from their phones than they can even through the church. The fourth point that I have is to embrace the Bible's call to embrace learning and knowledge. Embrace the Bible's call to embrace learning and knowledge. So we're still in the shadow of COVID. I mean, it's still being talked about, and it's amazing how, even though biologically most of it is behind us, the scars remain, and there's still a lot of people who are very hot on this issue. And during the COVID years, we saw a lot of Dunning-Kruger. Dunning-Kruger is that effect where the less you know about something, the more opinionated you are about it. It's this funny paradox of human nature. So the less you know about immunology, the more convinced you are that you understand B cells and vaccines, which doesn't make sense, but that's how humans are. And so because of Dunning-Kruger, because people have this false confidence, like, oh yeah, I know what I'm talking about, even though they've never taken a class in cell biology or immunology, but they're very sure about their views on it, you can't have a humble, data-driven, curious conversation. You have many people who don't know what they're speaking about, but then they will get very accusatory and unpleasant. There was a huge move that happened. If you're interested, you can ask me afterward about the specifics of this, but during the 1800s, the church really hitched its wagon to an anti-intellectual movement, and many people are still hitched to that wagon. It turned very anti-education, anti-learning, and like I said, we still live in that today. But it is so interesting to look at the Bible and to say, okay, is this what the Bible wants for us? Let's look, for example, at how the Bible describes Daniel, easily one of the great heroes of the Old Testament. It's actually describing all four of Daniel and his three friends. He said, Daniel 1:17 says, "As for these four youths, God gave them learning and skill in all literature and wisdom." It doesn't say that they were just so smart they picked it up, but it says that God gave them learning and skill in all literature and wisdom. There is something to be said about believing that God is the one who gave Daniel learning and skill in all literature, and something that he wants to continue to do. We had a speaker this week at Sattler who gave a pearl on, I think it was Tuesday, and she was talking about her own journey into faith, and she had this great phrase, I think I'm quoting it, although I'm not 100% sure, but she said something like, I met somebody for the first time who was intellectually well-formed, and I greatly respected and admired that person, and that individual ended up leading her into the faith. There's something about a person who is, as Daniel was, has learning and skill in all literature and wisdom. They understand different domains of life. They're not just ignoramuses who just bellow opinions, but they actually know what they're talking about. That's appealing. That's attractive. That's something that commands respect. Even later on, when Nebuchadnezzar calls Daniel, listen to what he says. "I have heard of you that the spirit of the gods is in you." Okay, so a little bit off there. "And that light and understanding and excellent wisdom are found in you." So Daniel had this reputation that caused him to be called by Nebuchadnezzar, because he had light, understanding, and excellent wisdom. We can also think about what God did to Solomon, how he gave him great wisdom, great learning, great understanding of nature, of theology, of all these different topics there. We're supposed to be excellent in our embrace of learning and understanding. There's a great little book. It's a short book. It would probably take you half an hour to read it. It's more of a booklet. It's called The Two Tasks. It's by Charles Malik. If you haven't read it, you should read it. He gives this speech, and in the speech, he says that the church has two tasks set before it: saving the soul and saving the mind. And that to the extent that it neglects the saving of the mind, it will also lose the soul as well. And that God has called the church to this great vocation of saving both the soul and the mind. Think about the time when the early church did grow in the first few centuries. It was led by the work of scholar evangelists. Think about how some of these people were such forces, such commanding forces that demanded the respect even among pagans. Justin Martyr, Irenaeus, Tertullian, Clement of Alexandria, Origen are just a small number of names of people who even the pagans would say, we're listening to them. These are not dummies. These are people who have applied themselves, who have embraced their learning and their studies. So, of course, do understanding and skill need to be coupled to virtue? Absolutely. But when they're joined together, that was essential to win over the Roman Empire. So work hard at school, those of you who are in school. Do well, if you're not in school, with your reading and study. Apply yourself diligently. So many people, even just recently, there was that claim of Jesus coming back on a certain date. And, you know, you just look at this and you just think, this person obviously has not applied themselves to the Word of God. The kinds of just foolish things that have made Christianity a laughingstock again and again and again. So we need to do this. And this is something that, again, I think we have fallen short on in this culture of argument. My fifth and final point is that we should be the friends of sinners. We should be the friends of sinners. And of course, this was what I referred to earlier. This is what people said about Jesus. He was their friend. He ate with them. He loved people without endorsing the sin. And I am very confident in this, that what happens so often, is somebody becomes a Christian, they learn about the Bible, they learn about holiness, they learn about these topics, and then they start to look at people, and the first thing they see, and the most dramatic thing they see about that person is their sin. They'll see this sin and that sin and this sin, and then they're turned off by it, and they don't want to make the connection. They don't want to relate because they're more turned off by their sin. It's very common, as Jonathan Swift said, this is my favorite Jonathan Swift quote. He said, "We have just enough religion to make us hate, but not enough to make us love." Very, very powerful insight there. This is so common in the world today. Aren't we glad that when God looked at us, he wasn't just repulsed by our sin, right? He could have said, like, man, look at that wicked person. I'm not even going to get near this individual. But of course, the greatness of our God is that he sees our sin. And that is far overshadowed by the humanity of the person, by the fact that this person is made in God's image. The great challenge that we need to embrace is, what does it look like to see a person and to see first and foremost, number one, number two, number three, this is somebody made in the image of God who Jesus died for, and to not be let their sins in some way overpower that. Remember that we are called to take the initiative. We're not supposed to just greet those who greet us. That's easy. The whole model of the incarnation is God coming down, God taking the initiative and entering into our world. This is what we're supposed to be doing. I was thinking about this in relation to just our own dinner schedule. We have a lot of people over in our home, and I was thinking about how we used to have over a person who was a double amputee. She didn't have legs, and it was a lot of work to go and pick her up and bring her over and help her, and then when she would come to her house, if she needed to use the toilet, it was a lot of work for Laura and all that. And now I think about it, and I think, you know what? Sometimes in caring for people like that, we forget that what Jesus said so clearly in Luke 14, he says, when you invite people over, don't invite your friends and your relatives. Invite, who did he say? The poor, the blind, the lame. Invite the very people that it's going to be the hardest to deal with, because they can't repay you. So the God will repay you on the resurrection of the just. So great test here is just think about your dinner table. Just take a survey of your dinner table. It's October now, over the last 6 months, and ask yourself how many people would be in that category of being the poor, the blind, the lame, the difficult. It's not easy having people like that over. It's a lot of work. How many people at your dinner table would qualify as being in that sinner category? People who are not professing any kind of faith. What does that look like? Have we failed in that? I think generally speaking, the church in the West has failed at that. Our job is to image, is to reflect, is to be what God would be to people and to a world around us that has a very warped idea of God. Think about that your job is to image the nature of the true God to the people around you. That's a challenging idea, and I think one of the most poignant places that we're supposed to be imaging that is right in our homes, right around our dinner tables. Have we done that? Do we take seriously Jesus' guest list? You know, this is not me telling you this. This is what Jesus said. He says, I'm giving you here the list of people I want you to invite into your home. As we think about inviting people over as being friend of sinners, that whole endeavor, there's a person who put it really well in a poignant way. He says something like, if non-Christians, if the sinners, if people on the outside don't love you, they won't love your God. And again, I think that's right, that there is something about how people are supposed to be experiencing God through us. That is very sobering. As I said, I think this is generally a large failure area for the church. In conclusion here, I have tried to say that in the midst of a tenuous time, and we've had some tenuous moments even on our street in the last couple of weeks, with some interesting moments here. How do we in the church, become winsome and regain that credibility? How do we become the salt of the earth and the light of the world so that we're not thrown out and trampled underfoot by men? I've given you five ways in which we can and should be doing this. Number one, I said, to vigorously reject today's argument culture. Number two, to vigorously embrace an action-oriented culture of good works and love. Number three, to recognize the true sources of the body's discipleship. Number four, to embrace the Bible's call to embrace learning and knowledge. And then fifth and finally, to be a friend of sinners. If we could do those five, what a world it would be. What a church it would be. It would be something that was winsome. It would be beautiful and beautifully proportioned. The whole idea of what Jesus is saying in Matthew 5 with being this city on the hill, this light of the world, or being this this body that is known for love, or this body that is known for unity, that all of those elements have the attraction of something that's beautiful. You know, a lot of times when people think about apologetics or something like that, they think of debates, they think of arguing, they think of those sorts of things. Okay, and there, maybe there is a place occasionally for loving places where discussions can be had. But I think more often than not, the world that we're in right now is just, it's not as much logic that is required or moves of like, hey, read this book, but it's more of a need for actually just seeing what's beautiful and what is winsome. I think this is why Dostoevsky, the famous Russian writer, said this. Most people don't understand this quote, but I think this is the intent of what he meant when he said, beauty will save the world. That this is what is needed today more than anything. So let's go to God in prayer, and then I'll hand it over to Brother David for a concluding song. And I would like to discuss afterward about what the good works are that Jesus refers to in Matthew 5. Father in heaven, we recognize in our increasingly polarized country that many people are confused, even frightened at some of the recent violence that has occurred. We want to know how to be effective in responding, not reactionary, but biblical. I do pray that you would help us to be blameless in this warped and crooked generation, that we would shine like stars. I pray for help in being a friend of sinners. Change our hearts so that we, when we look at people, we are just overwhelmingly dominated by the worthiness that individual has, not because of anything other than being created by you and being loved by you, and that their sin doesn't cancel that out. Thank you that you loved us enough to overlook our sins and to come to us graciously without merit. I pray that you would help us to be a people that model how Jesus interacted, how he was wise with his use of parables, and how he did create something so beautiful and so loving and so winsome that for centuries the church grew and grew with such impressive quality and strength. I pray that you would help us to recapture these elements for the sake of your Son.